truth, justice and steadfastness. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Millions of pilgrims on their way back home after attending Arbaeen mourning ceremonies in the Iraqi city of Karbala. The Iraqi government has taken various measures to facilitate their return. And neighboring Iran is also lending a hand, offering special services, not just to Iranian citizens, but to pilgrims from other countries as well. Many of the Iranian mukebs, or tents, that were set up to serve the pilgrims across the Arab country are still there. And Iran's Karbala Consulate Special Arbaeen Section, tasked with helping the pilgrims, will remain operational for another week.
Here at the operation room, we not only give information to the pilgrims, but we also provide them with assistance in case they encounter any problems. There are several committees that follow up on issues that the pilgrims face and contact us for. We are here to offer a helping hand, not just to fellow Iranians, but to pilgrims coming from other countries as well.
For any cross-border traveler, travel insurance is a must, and the Islamic Republic has come up with an innovative solution to help out all pilgrims.
Considering the fact that the Arbaeen Walk is a major international event, we have tried to create an infrastructure to offer travel insurance to non-Iranians as well. And with the database that we have, we will be able to provide even more cost-effective insurance plans for pilgrims next year.
Meanwhile, field hospitals and mobile medical units set up by the Iranian Red Crescent Society remain active until all pilgrims leave, to take care of casualties on site and, if necessary, safely transport them to hospitals.
I had a fever and I wasn't feeling well. An ambulance quickly picked me up and brought me to this medical facility. Everything was free of charge.
My friend wasn't feeling well since yesterday, so as soon as we arrived in Karbala, I brought him here. It was quite easy to find this medical center. It was nearby.
Arbaeen is by far the biggest annual religious gathering in the world. This year, over 22 million people took part.
Over 4 million Iranians crossed the Iran-Iraq border to come to the city of Karbala this year and take part in the Arbaeen ceremonies. Yusuf Shahmadi, Karbala.
There is no end in sight to the suffering of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip amid Tel Aviv's inhumane practices. The Israeli regime has placed a ban on the export of goods from Gaza to the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds since Tuesday, further exacerbating the dire economic situation in the impoverished territory. The Kerem Shalom commercial crossing, located on the southernmost tip of the Gaza Strip, has been partially operating since Israel imposed a tight blockade on Gaza in 2007. Israeli security forces claim to have thwarted an attempt to smuggle explosive materials through the crossing on Monday. Observers say the Israeli claim is possibly an excuse for future military aggression against the Gaza Strip.
The impact of the restrictions and the siege is very harsh and very hard against Palestinian people. I think this comes in order to continue this collective punishment against Palestinians who's living in Gaza, and to give Israeli government a justification for any military action.
The Israeli decision to ban exports from Gaza has inflicted heavy losses on the private sector and its various segments. It has deprived businessmen and manufacturers of the ability to market their products, disrupting production and employment.
Stopping exports from the Kerem Shalom crossing has had a grave impact on many factories in Gaza, including my factory. Currently, I'm working with only one-third of my employees because I can't afford to pay salaries. If this catastrophic situation continues, I will lose my business and all my employees will be out of work.
In addition to the ban on exports, the Israeli regime limits the quantity of the goods allowed into the impoverished territory and bans the entry of most raw materials for factories. The Palestinian NGOs Network, which represents over 140 Palestinian civil society organizations, says Tel Aviv's move to ban exports will further complicate living conditions in Gaza. According to officials in Gaza, businesses are losing $500,000 daily because of the export ban. Experts say the Israeli blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip since 2007 has wreaked havoc on the economy of Gaza and has had grave humanitarian consequences. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
...23-year-old Wazir Azrar arrives at the Federal Agency for Asylum Seekers in Brussels, having been in Belgium for 6 months. Wazir says Western powers destroyed his country, Afghanistan, and now help is not available. Officials at the agency rejected his documents.
I have been waiting for that for 6 months. I've been sleeping on the street, also like in the park. Yeah. This is a big problem here in Belgium for the Afghan refugees and also for the Syrian refugees, you know.
A coach full of families then arrives, and those people are granted access to the asylum application centre. This is because the Belgian government, led by Alexander De Croo, says male refugees travelling alone are no longer welcome in the country.
They're thinking we are just animals and refugees. They don't respect us. That's why I camp here. For example, we need like doctors, like these very important things, but they don't care also.
Hundreds of men, mainly from Africa and the Middle East, are sleeping on the streets of Belgium. At the same time, the country is providing full protection to 62,000 Ukrainian refugees. They enjoy the same rights as EU citizens. The European Commission says it is aware of reports that Belgium is rejecting asylum applications from non-Ukrainian single men.
We understand that these are announcements at this stage, so this is still being discussed by the Belgian government, so we will need to see what is exactly happening, and the Commission will be contacting also the Belgian authorities in this respect.
De Croo's administration insists families, women and children must be prioritised as winter approaches. Groups such as Amnesty International claim the Belgian government has reached a new low. They are demanding that authorities here start respecting EU asylum laws and international asylum laws. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Erdogan arrived in Sochi on the eve of the G20 summit. This was his first visit to Russia since his re-election in May. The Turkish official began the meeting with his Russian counterpart by expressing gratitude for Moscow's assistance in extinguishing forest fires and also efforts in eliminating the consequences of a powerful February earthquake. The two sides continued with the topic of the gas hub, which is also their common project. But it was clear that the topic of Ukraine and the grain deal were the main items on the agenda of Recep Tayyip Erdogan in the trip.
We are determined to continue efforts to establish lasting peace, stability and prosperity in our region. We previously hosted the direct negotiations between the conflicting parties. As before, we are ready to do our best and act as a mediator.
Erdogan arrived on the eve of the G20 summit in New Delhi. Therefore, the issue of the grain deal was also raised, from which Russia withdrew, since not a single promise given by the Western partners was fulfilled. Putin noted that the withdrawal of Russia does not affect the food crisis. In addition, Russia is ready to come up with several initiatives at once.
We intend to organize the supply of 1 million ton of grain from Russia at a preferential price for processing to Turkey and then free transportation to the poor countries. In this sense, we count on the help from the Qatari state, who is ready to support the poorest countries for humanitarian reasons.
According to the Russian leader, the initiative is not a replacement for the grain deal, but would make a great contribution to solving the food problem in the African countries. The visit by the Turkish president turned out to be quite short, just a few hours, and no documents were signed.
Turkey's hopes to extend the grain deal did not come true. However, Moscow and Ankara are already engaged in several joint projects. Russia is building the Akuyu nuclear power plant, and the state of the gas hub, which diversifies Russian gas supplies to Europe, also depends on Moscow. Russia is actively supporting Turkey in various sectors of the national economy, ranging from banking to metallurgy. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
T tensions remain high in Sweden after the Holy Quran was desecrated in the city of Malmö on Sunday. A notorious Iraqi hate preacher has been attacking Islam's holy text on a routine basis for weeks. His antics led to an angry response as 15 people were arrested following confrontations with the police. Police provided protection for the offensive action and even arrested some Muslims who tried to save the Quran from the flames. Cities up and down Sweden are all being affected by these anti-Islam incidents. This mosque in central Stockholm has routinely been the victim of Quran desecration antics, many of which have been taking place right outside their front doorsteps and with police protection at that. The Muslim world has responded angrily, trying to pressure the Swedish authorities to curb this rising trend in Islamophobic stunts. A local Swedish Muslim activist explained how the government's defense of hate speech is costing Sweden dearly.
Almost majority of Swedish people, they don't like these actions, you know, because this will destroy Swedish reputation in the world. And this kind of acts may hurt millions of Muslims all over the world. So to let this thing just happen in this country. We almost see the Finland, like for example, and even Denmark right now, they are studying the things that they will prohibit the burning of Quran. So why cannot Sweden do that?
Though acknowledging that these acts hurt Sweden's image and put its security at risk, the authorities here have shown no concrete signs of changing the laws to protect Muslims from hate preachers. Swedish security services have also admitted the country's security situation has deteriorated following the Quran burnings. Robert Carter, Stockholm.
People from all walks of life march several kilometers in the sun, converging on the Suleja town. Throughout their trek, they engage in mourning and vehemently denounce the brutal murder of Imam Hussein, his family members, and his steadfast companions. Groups of people standing by the roadside offered weary trekkers food and juice along the route of the long walk. The participants in the procession say they continue to grieve even 40 days after the anniversary of Imam Hussein's martyrdom.
As we came out today, massively in commemorating, showing a solidarity, showing a love and a condolence for the killing of his grandson, Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Abba Abdullah, which is the savior of Islam. If not Imam Hussein, Islam could have been another story.
A procession of marchers weaved through the streets of Suleja and gathered in a designated location to engage in prayers dedicated to Imam Hussein and those who were martyred with him. The marchers emphasized the enduring legacy of Imam Hussein's martyrdom, underscoring its continued significance and relevance to present-day global issues.
His actions 1,400 years back are something to be emulated and something that will never be forgotten, and something as far as this world exists, the name of Imam Husseini and the actions he took against tyrant Yazid will never be forgotten.
The participants in the march here say it is another act of mourning for the pain of Imam Hussein during the incidents that led to his martyrdom and the martyrdom of his family members and companions in the Battle of Karbala. Danjuma Abdullahi, Suleja.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. Limelight.
According to U.S. lawmakers who were present during a recent closed-door questioning, Devon Archer, a former business associate and longtime friend of Hunter Biden, testified that the president's son used the Biden brand to his advantage while working for Ukrainian energy company Burisma. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Fox News Channel has covered this story and tells us more. U.S. House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer said Devon Archer, a former business associate and longtime friend of Hunter Biden, confirmed in his appearance on Monday, 31st of July, that President Joe Biden lied to the American people when he said he had no knowledge about his son's business dealings and was not involved. James Comer's comments came after Devon Archer sat for hours before the House Oversight Committee in a closed-door hearing on Monday. Devon Archer said that Hunter Biden put his father, then Vice President Joe Biden, on speakerphone while meeting with business partners at least 20 times. Devon Archer described how Joe Biden was put on the phone to sell the brand. The House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer said Joe Biden was the brand that his son sold around the world to enrich the Biden family. Comer added, when Joe Biden was Vice President of the United States, he joined Hunter Biden's dinners with his foreign business associates in person or by speakerphone over 20 times. James Comer continued by saying, when Burisma's owner was facing pressure from the Ukrainian prosecutor investigating the company for corruption, Devon Archer testified that Burisma executives asked Hunter Biden to call Washington, D.C. after a Burisma board meeting in Dubai. He asked, why did Joe Biden lie to the American people about his family's business dealings and his involvement? He added, it begs the question what else he's hiding from the American people. The House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer said, the House Committee on Oversight and Accountability will continue to follow the Biden's money trail and interview witnesses to determine whether foreign actors targeted the Bidens. President Biden is compromised and corrupt, and our national security is threatened. Devon Archer's attorney, Matthew Schwartz, the managing partner of Boies Schiller Flexner LLP, released a statement on Monday, 31st of July, following his client's testimony. Matthew Schwartz said, we're aware that all sides are claiming victory following Devon Archer's voluntary interview today. But all Devon Archer did was exactly what he said he would do, show up and answer the questions put to him honestly and completely. Matthew Schwartz added, Devon Archer shared the truth with the committee, and we will leave to them and others to decide what to do with it. James Comer detailed the key takeaways from Devon Archer's hour-long testimony on Monday. Devon Archer, who served on the board of Ukrainian natural gas firm Burisma Holdings alongside Hunter Biden beginning in 2014, told lawmakers that the value of adding Hunter Biden to the board, executive board, was to build the company's brand. According to James Comer, Devon Archer confirmed that then-Vice President Joe Biden was the brand. Archer also testified that Burisma would have gone out of business if the brand had not been attached to it. According to James Comer's office, Devon Archer said he believed that Hunter Biden being on the board and the Biden brand contributed to Burisma's longevity, and suggested that people would have been intimidated to mess with Burisma legally because of the Biden brand. Meanwhile, Devon Archer testified about an interaction in December of 2015 involving Burisma's chief executive officer, Mykola Zrochevsky, and Vadim Pozharsky, an executive at the firm. Devon Archer said Zlochevsky and Pozharsky placed constant pressure on Hunter Biden to get help from Washington, D.C. in getting Ukrainian prosecutor Viktor Shokin ousted. Viktor Shokin was investigating Burisma for corruption. According to the source, Devon Archer testified that on 4th of December 2015, Hunter Biden, Zlochevsky and Pozharsky called Washington, D.C. to discuss the matter. Devon Archer testified that Biden, Zlochevsky and Pozharsky stepped away to make the call. It is unclear if Hunter Biden and the Burisma executive spoke directly to Joe Biden on that matter, though at the time Joe Biden was in charge of U.S.-Ukraine policy for the Barack Obama administration. A source confirmed that Devon Archer testified that just days later, on 9th of December 2015, Joe Biden traveled to Ukraine and made a speech. Biden, during that speech, said the government needed to fix the Ukrainian prosecutor's office. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jim Jordan told Fox News Channel, "This is the most revealing aspect of Devon Archer's testimony and may be the most important in our entire investigation so far." National broadcaster NBC News has also covered the same story. The testimony of Devon Archer, a longtime friend of Hunter Biden, comes after U.S. media first reported on an unclassified version of an FBI-generated FD-1023 form, which contained charges that Joe Biden and Hunter Biden coerced Zlochevsky to pay them millions of dollars in exchange for their help in getting Ukrainian prosecutor Viktor Shokin fired. Biden has acknowledged that when he was vice president, he successfully pressured Ukraine to fire prosecutor Viktor Shokin. At the time, Viktor Shokin was investigating Burisma Holdings, and at the time, Hunter Biden had a highly lucrative role on the executive board, receiving thousands of dollars per month. The then vice president threatened to withhold $1 billion of critical U.S. aid if Viktor Shokin was not fired. Biden allies maintained that then-Vice President pushed for Shokin's firing due to concerns the Ukrainian prosecutor went easy on corruption, and say that his firing at the time was the policy position of the U.S. and international community. James Comer said that the December 2015 phone call from Biden, Zlochevsky and Pozharsky to Washington, D.C., raises concerns that Hunter Biden was in violation of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Federal prosecutors, during Hunter Biden's recent court appearance, in which he pled not guilty to federal tax crimes and a felony gun charge, hinted that the Justice Department is investigating Hunter Biden for potential violations of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Meanwhile, James Comer said that Devon Archer testified that Hunter Biden put then-Vice President Joe Biden under speakerphone during the business meetings over 20 times, despite the White House and Joe Biden himself denying ever having been in business with Hunter Biden or having ever been involved. According to Devon Archer, the phone calls and meetings included a dinner in Paris with a French energy company and in China with Jonathan Lee, the chief executive officer of BHR Partners, a joint venture between Rosemont Seneca and Chinese investment firm Bohai Capital. BHR Partners is a Beijing-backed private equity firm controlled by Bank of China Limited. Devon Archer also testified that then-Vice President Joe Biden had coffee with Jonathan Lee, the chief executive officer of BHR in Beijing. Then Vice President Joe Biden even wrote a letter of recommendation for college for Jonathan Lee's daughter. Moreover, Devon Archer testified that in the spring of 2014, then-Vice President Biden attended a business dinner with his son, Hunter Biden, and his associates at Cafe Milano in Washington, D.C. Elena Baturina, a Russian oligarch who is the widow of the former mayor of Moscow, attended that dinner. James Comer's office said, notably, the Biden administration's public sanctions list for Russian oligarchs does not contain Baturina. The White House reacted to Devon Archer's testimony on Monday, 31st of July. White House spokesperson Ian Sam said, it appears that the House Republicans' own much-hyped witness today testified that he never heard of President Biden discussing business with his son or his son's associates or doing anything wrong. House Republicans keep promising bombshell evidence to support their ridiculous attacks against the president, but time and time they keep failing to produce any.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. A former Mossad chief admits that the Israeli regime is enforcing an apartheid system in the occupied Palestinian territories. This comes against the backdrop of fresh round of violence by the Israeli military against Palestinians. The Israeli regime is also coming under increasing fire over its treatment of Palestinian women. The United Nations has demanded a probe into the forced stripping of five Palestinian women by Israeli soldiers during a raid in the occupied West Bank. Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have spokesperson of Masar Badil movement, Khalid Barakat, joining us from Vancouver. And also attorney, activist, and political analyst, Zakir Ahmad Mayet, joining us from Johannesburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Barakat in Vancouver. The Israeli regime has increased its deadly acts of aggression against the Palestinians, most notably since late December 2022. That's when the ultra-right-wing cabinet of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu assumed office. Just today, Israeli forces have again attacked anti-settlement protests across the occupied West Bank, leaving dozens of Palestinians injured. Give us your perspective on this heavy escalation by the Israelis.
Thank you for the invitation. Well, Israel is continuing its daily crimes with impunity, and particularly in the last few months with the current extreme right-wing government led by Israeli settlers. And we have been seeing that more and more Israeli crimes are being committed, especially during night raids. There's not one single day that passes without Israeli soldiers invading Palestinian towns, villages, refugee camps, and cities, including the reports that have been just printed by even Israeli media of how Israeli soldiers and Israeli woman soldiers attacked Palestinian families and forced Palestinian women to basically strip their clothes in front of their children and humiliate them, you know, and attack them with police dogs, threaten them with police dogs. These are daily crimes that it's happening in Palestine, across Palestine, particularly in the West Bank and Jerusalem. And the Palestinian resistance, this is one of the reasons why the Palestinian resistance is also escalating on the other hand. What we are witnessing in Palestine is an intensified, the conflict has been intensified, and we are going to witness more escalation from Israeli side and also more resistance from the Palestinian side.
Mr. Zakir Ahmad Mayet, the Israeli regime is facing growing criticism over its soldiers' forced stripping of five Palestinian women during a raid in the occupied West Bank in July. Give us your perspective on these insulting actions, which reportedly has become more prevalent as of late. The United Nations has demanded a probe into this practice, but it's the inaction of the likes of the UN, isn't it, that has led the Israelis to act in this manner and to believe that they are above the law?
A blank check has been given to Israel to commit atrocities against Palestinians, from daily humiliations at checkpoints to the establishment of new settlements stealing Palestinian land to unilateral actions of administrative detention and executions on a daily basis. However, the dignity of women, particularly within Palestine and surrounding areas, is of paramount importance. And we have heard sporadic incidents of this over the many years. However, we see this as an intensified policy that has now been adopted under the ultra-orthodox right-wing government of Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. And I think that Netanyahu is just a bystander trying to save his own skin from the judicial fire. That being said, the international community has created a situation where Israel's apartheid, Israel's mechanisms of oppression have been accepted. Hence, we see this escalation in the humiliation of the Palestinian people. And this is seen through all the allies that Israel seems to keep. We see a similar conduct taking place within India towards the Muslim communities there. We see exactly the same thing happening in Palestine. And this is because of, as you rightly say, the global community's inaction. The United Nations has mandated numerous probes into Israel, whether it was Operation Cast Lead 2008 to 2009. We know that at the moment in the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice, there are cases that are pending in front of them regarding Israel, and yet till today we haven't seen a single Israeli military official or political official behind bars or an indictment for them. However, you have an expedited system for individuals from Russia, for example, because of Ukraine, with clear double standards and the hypocrisy. Therefore, it comes as no surprise that our women are being subjected, our sisters are being subjected to this humiliation. However, the answer is coming on a daily basis from the resistance. There's retaliatory attacks on a daily basis, and this is causing havoc for the Israeli security establishment.
Right, Mr. Barakat, anger is boiling over regarding this issue, as dozens of Jordanian lawmakers have now denounced Israel's forced stripping of the five Palestinian women during that raid that took place in the occupied West Bank. They are urging the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador to Amman and are calling on other parliaments around the world to take practical measures against the regime's crimes. Of course, collective action is a big step forward. Maybe this could set a precedent against future Israeli violations against Palestinians.
Yes, and in particularly in Jordan, as you know, the vast majority of the population in Jordan are Palestinians, more than 70%. And the entire population of Jordan, whether Jordanians or Palestinians, Palestine for them is the central issue. The regime of Jordan, however, is not just normalizing relationship with Israel, but also signed a so-called peace agreement since 1994, the Wadi Araba agreement. And the regime is trying to release some of the pressure by allowing some kind of, statements that we have seen it before many, many times, whether from the parliament or whether from lawmakers. Now, these are good gestures, but it is expected more from the popular movement and the representatives of the people in Jordan to play a key role. And the demand is to end the relationship between Jordan and Israel, end any agreements between Egypt and Israel. And the unfortunate factor here is the role that the Palestinian Authority play in this whole scheme of normalization. The Palestinian Authority is basically a group of collaborators who works to secure their own BT interests at the expense of the Palestinian people. And they are now playing also a very dirty and dangerous game by trying to cover the Saudi regime moves in public normalization with the Zionist regime. And the Palestinian Authority is playing that role. And it's being exposed on a popular level. The Palestinian Authority and the Mahmoud Abbas have no legitimacy in Palestine. The Palestinian people are rejecting the PA policies, normalization policies. And in Jordan, particularly, because it has the longest borders with Palestine, previously Palestinians have carried military operation and they were shot by Jordanian regime army. Palestinians once, especially in the Shatat, in the diaspora, they want to participate in the armed struggle. They want to participate in the struggle to liberate Palestine. But these regimes are playing a reactionary role because of their alliance with the United States and with Israel, particularly right. In Egypt and Jordan.
Mr. Mayat, a former head of Israel's spy agency Mossad has admitted that the regime is enforcing an apartheid system on the occupied West Bank. Tamir Pardo warned that the greatest catastrophe awaits Israel as it's reaching a place similar to South Africa. That's, of course, a reference to the past apartheid regime there. Apartheid needs international action. So when will we see this international action? What more does the world need to see and hear?
I think you've answered your own question with the question itself. The international community has known that Israel is an apartheid state for some time. The statements of the former head of the Mossad, Tamir Pardo, recently has just been a nail that has been recognized the world around. South Africans, such as the late Archbishop Desmond Tutu, traveled to Palestine and observed the apartheid regime in action. Numerous South Africans that carry true gravitas have gone to the occupied territories, have gone to Israel proper, have gone to Gaza, and have said that the Israeli regime is practicing apartheid. So this is not something new. However, Tamir Pardo had written an article on the 16th of August for an organization. They refer to themselves as Security First, Commanders for the Security of Israel. And in that article, he says something very interesting, and this fits into a larger picture. He says that the caravan of Netanyahu has been hooked up with the Hariris, it's been hooked up with fascists, it's been hooked up with racists, anti-Zionists, ultra-nationalists. And this is very heavy language that comes out of the former head of the Mossad. Interestingly enough, it was Netanyahu who appointed him the head of the Mossad at that period of time. Further than that, we've heard another senior official, and this was in April of this year, Moshe Bogi Yalon, former defense minister, referring to Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich as people that want to bring about an apocalyptic messianic war. And he actually said that they are trying to implement the reverse Mein Kampf, which is referring to fascism, which is referring to Hitler, the book of Hitler. This is extremely heavy language from senior officials within the military establishment. Therefore, I think we've gone actually beyond the title of apartheid, because apartheid was already referred to by individuals like Tzipi Livni and Ehud Barak during the IDC Hezliya conference that they are slipping into an apartheid regime already 2015, 2016. We are talking about a fascist state. Israel has gone far beyond the apartheid regime. It's even worse than apartheid that was experienced here in South Africa. That's not my commentary. It's those individuals that have gone to Palestine from South Africa, who have fought in the resistance struggle here in South Africa against apartheid, and they have made this commentary. What we are looking at now, and if we look at the larger context from the seriousness of the individuals making these statements, is that Israel, they've read the writing on the wall. Israel is on its deathbed. They know this, that the only solution now is to try and throw Netanyahu under the proverbial bus and try and save what is left of Israel. That, for example, if Israel is rid of Netanyahu, Bezalel Smotrich, and Itamar Ben-Gvir, then it ceases to be an apartheid state. That's incorrect. It was established on the principles of racism. It was established on the principles of dispossession of the Palestinian people, and therefore the entire entity is foreign. However, the other issue is the disintegration of the Israeli military, number one. Number two is the strengthening position of the resistance surrounding Israel, and it is very clear that Israel has no future. Therefore, these officials have seen the writing on the wall, they recognize that Israel is on his deathbed, and they are now planning for the future, which is very similar, in my opinion, to that of South Africa, where we are talking about minority rights and a one-state solution, where the Palestinian people will dictate what the future will be and the formulation of government. I think that is where we are in the discourse now. It's no longer about Israel as an apartheid state, not about conscientization about Palestine. We all know these facts. It's about the death of Israel now. That's what we're talking about post the state of Israel.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Right, Khaled Barakat, the right-wing government of Netanyahu is facing increased dissatisfaction and demonstrations from Israelis. The leader of the Hamas resistance movement, Ismail Haniyeh, has said in the past that the Israeli regime is in decline both on the military front and domestically. Is the regime now trying to divert attention and to reassert itself via the use of deadly force?
Yes, of course. Israel is trying to do everything in its power to exit the existentialist crisis that it entered. And it's going to be very hard to do that. And in my view, it's impossible. The Zionist regime have entered a stage of crisis that it's going to be very hard to come out from it. And Israel, of course, it possesses a very strong military and economic power, and it enjoys a very strong relationship with the United States and the Western powers that are keeping the Israeli project alive by funding it, by supporting it, but that's not going to help at all. Israel doesn't have any strategic depth in the region. It does not belong to the region. This settler colonialist colony state is collapsing despite its power, and the Palestinian people and the Arab people resistance is growing. Today in the region, we have two camps. One camp that it's led by the United States, and when I say the region, I mean the entire Arab homeland and West Asia. The one camp is led by the United States, Israel, and some Arab reactionary regimes, and the other camp is led by Iran and the resistance movement and the people movements in the region. This is today, these two camps today are in direct confrontation, and our camp, the resistance camp, is growing. It's gaining momentum. It's gaining a lot of popular support. Today, if you do polls in Palestine, Lebanon, Egypt, anywhere in the Arab world, the overwhelming majority of the people are with the resistance, and they see that Israel is defeatable. They saw that in 2006 in South Lebanon. They're seeing this in Gaza. And the Palestinian resistance is growing. This is a fact. Israel is recognizing this. Today, Israel is very careful of how it calculates its policies in the region. And we see that its internal front is collapsing. It's not united, and it's not just about secular and religious conflicts. We see Israel racist nature being exposed again, when they carry not just their policies against the Palestinian people, but even against people from Africa who lives in Palestine. And Palestinians were always in support of those who needs a place and safety throughout the history of Palestine. But in the case of Israel, we see that they want to maintain a Western colony that is based, as Brother Zakir indicated, a colony that is completely, similar to South Africa, where Zionists are ruling the entire land of Palestine and the entire region. And I think Israel is, we are witnessing the declining of the Zionist project to its end.
Mr. Ahmed Mayet, there was another act of aggression by Israeli regime forces against Al-Aqsa Mosque as they broke into one of the prayer halls at the holy site. Witnesses said that the Friday morning attack caused extensive damage to the prayer hall. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the raid and called the attack a new crime, which is part of a religious war against Al-Aqsa and the city of Al-Quds itself. What do you believe are the motives of the Israelis by attacking and desecrating Al-Aqsa?
You have a right-wing government headed by individuals like Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. If you look at Itamar Ben-Gvir, he's the same individual who represented the attackers of the Dawabshi family and argued for their release. He's the same individual that had a frame of the attacker, Baruch Goldstein, who massacred worshippers in the Ibrahimian Mosque. He had this man's photograph in his lounge. This is also confirmed by Moshe Bogi Yalon in his Hebrew interview. These are the types of individuals that are heading the government. It therefore comes as no surprise that you are seeing escalations within the most holy of sites, the Masjid al-Aqsa, Harem al-Sharif, and you see these consistent violations. You see the increase in the number of settler raids on the holy precinct, and you see this on a daily basis, protected by the Israeli police force. Yes, it is taking a religious dimension. Yes, I understand that we are heading in that direction. It is for that particular reason that the Islamic resistance movement, Al-Muqawama al-Islamiyya, has joined links and arms. They have a joint operations room, and they will exact revenge. There are certain red lines. I fully agree with my co-panelist that Israel is constrained. They have a few options on the table for them. Escalations at Masjid al-Aqsa, escalations within the West Bank, and yet we see with the Jenin operation, Operation Home and Garden, that they were not able to crush the resistance in Jenin. A handful of soldiers have overcome a larger group. All of that is praise to the Almighty. We cannot look at it in any other way. And this is indeed the death of the Israeli regime. It's the destruction of the Israeli regime. The military officials see the writing on the wall. Israel is tearing itself apart internally. They don't have a functional army any longer. The reserves are rejecting additional training and reporting for reserve duty. They are left with their standing army, which is not capable. And you even have rejections coming from inside Israel, such as the chief of staff, Herzi Halevi, standing in full opposition in his recent speech the last 2 days to the Netanyahu government. This is a complete position of chaos for Israel, and this is a boon for the resistance, and we will see the liberation of Palestine in our lifetime, God willing, inshallah.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Mr. Khaled Barakat, spokesperson of the Masar Badal movement, joining us from Vancouver, and thanks to Zakir Ahmad Mayat, attorney, activist, and political analyst, joining us from Johannesburg. A special thanks to your viewers for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now, and see you next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.